My guest today on Takes on the World for the fifth time, Philip Giraldi, is a former CIA counterterrorism specialist, a military intelligence officer who served 18 years overseas in Turkey, Italy, Germany, and Spain. He is a founding member of the Veterans Intelligence Professional for Sanity, or VIPS, and currently serves as president of the Council for the National Interest, an organization of former members of Congress and government officials who believe that U.S. support for Israel is not in America's interest. His weekly columns appear online in the UNS Review, and he is a contributing editor, writes a deep background column on terrorism, intelligence, and security issues for the American Conservative magazine. He has been interviewed on virtually every major TV network in the U.S. and most of the important ones abroad, and I was happy to have him as a guest on Takes on the World going back to 2008. Welcome once again, Phil Giraldi, to Takes on the World.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, it's great to have you, and it's great to read your column every week in the UNS Review. In the following November elections, I read one of those columns. It was entitled "American Stupid, Bombs Away, McCain at the Helm," in which you described the Republican Party as being the heart and soul of something you called "American Stupid," and what Senator John McCain is likely to do as a new chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee. How scary are the prospects?
Well, the thing that astonishes me about the Republican Party is that they persist in supporting policies that don't benefit Americans. It's the wars of the last 13 years have not brought a single benefit to the United States. They haven't made us safer. They've cost us huge amounts of money. They've killed 6,000 approximately of our soldiers and uncounted thousands of foreigners. And yet these policies seem to drive them. So what I was trying to say in the article is that, the elections have really done a great thing for us. They've brought back into power. These guys are going to do a lot of goofy stuff.
We've been hearing McCain regularly on the national media as the ranking Republican, more than the hearing comments from the committee chair, Carl Levin, and now with him, we hear from him all the time on a regular basis. He travels around the world, McCain, and he's never seen a war he doesn't like or somebody fighting the godless enemy that he doesn't like. How much power will he have, and who will be joining him on this Foreign Services Committee, Armed Services Committee, that will push for greater sanctions on Iran and pushing for another war in the Middle East?
Yeah, well, basically, it's true that the president is essentially the executive of the country, and he has a lot of the say over how troops are employed and war and peace. But what you're going to have here is with a Senate majority, with a majority of Republicans on the Armed Services Committee, on the Intelligence Committee, on foreign policy, you're going to have a constant push for more aggression in every area. You're going to have basically, as you suggested, they will certainly do their best to torpedo any kind of agreement with Iran. They will certainly do their best to put more ground troops into Iraq, Syria, and to up that engagement. They'll probably prolong our stay in Afghanistan by pushing for more troops. So there's going to be this constant pressure coming from these guys. And while they can't unilaterally make the decisions to do these things, they do have a lot of influence in the media, as you also mentioned. McCain is on Sunday talk shows every Sunday. And you don't see people from the administration there trying to counter what he's saying. He has better access to the media than they do. So this is the danger, that suddenly we're going to have a constant agitation for policies that basically are not good for the United States and not good for the American people.
Well, in a more recent column entitled, which written a week ago, called "Promoting the Apocalypse, You'll Be Dead Before You Know It," great titles. You go back to President Eisenhower's farewell address, in which he warned about the military-industrial complex, and you add something else to that, which seems to be very significant given Republican taking power in Washington, you refer to suggesting that think tanks be added to the military-industrial complex, think tanks. Can you elaborate on what the problem is with these think tanks and what influence they have in Washington?
Sure. I mean, the big problem, the fundamental problem with the think tanks is that the think tanks give what I would call intellectual credibility to the war party, and that's basically why they exist. These think tanks have been, for the people who haven't followed it, have been proliferating in Washington for a long time, and the majority of them have the same kind of agenda, which is an aggressive foreign policy that they support all around the world. And why is this the case? Well, if you look deeper, you see that it's the defense industries and the military industry essentially fund a lot of these think tanks, and then these people get credibility because they have a well-funded organization in Washington. They get access to the media, and the cycle goes on and on. So basically, these think tanks are kind of a new thing, dating after certainly Eisenhower. But these things are very dangerous because they project a certain viewpoint. They're well-funded, and they have good access to the media.
And one other aspect of them, as you've pointed out, is they also tend to be very pro-Israel and try to see U.S. foreign policy or direct it in ways that appear to be beneficial to Israel.
Yeah, that's a sine qua non, that all of these think tanks, whether they're progressive in nature, because, you know, progressives do this too. They just call it their responsibility to protect. They call it spreading democracy. But they all have a similar kind of worldview, which is that the United States should be asserting its authority. And they're all pro-Israel. I can't think of a single think tank offhand in Washington of maybe 100 of them that is seriously critical of the relationship with Israel. I can't think of a single one. So this is something that drives them. And if you look, again, if you look at the boards of directors, the prominent neocons, most of whom are Jewish, are on the boards of all these organizations.
One of the troubling things, and you've written about this as well, is the role of the Kagans. Robert Kagan was John McCain's foreign policy advisor. He's now Hillary Clinton's foreign policy advisor. He was the founder, as you point out, of the Project for New American Century, along with Bill Kristol, and as well as its successor, Foreign Policy Initiative, which is something that's interesting that most critics of the U.S. government, even of Israeli policy, don't talk about much. We've talked.
Yeah, that's for sure. It's basically it's like a revolving door. You know, the people who are in these think tanks start out in a certain place, usually in academia. Then they get into the think tanks, and from the think tanks they get into government. Then they go out again where they get into a higher level of think tank and media, and then they go back into the government at an even higher level. And if you follow the trajectory of all these people, that's essentially how they work. And the Kagan family, of course, is famous. It's the two Kagan brothers, and also Kimberly, and Victoria Nuland, wife of the other Kagan, and so this is basically, I mean, if you looked at it as a conspiracy, I mean, it kind of is that way. It's a family conspiracy. These people have been moving from government into think tanks, into the media, and back and forth, and as advisors to not just John McCain but also Mitt Romney, and now Hillary Clinton. And it's quite incredible to watch.
What do you think, speaking of scary prospects, Hillary Clinton candidacy would do for the Democratic Party or to the Democratic Party?
Well, Hillary, Hillary is kind of like her husband, is a person who kind of plays every side of the issue. You can see it in some of her foreign policy pronouncements, where she hedges her bets on what she's saying and how she's presenting herself. But the fact is, I think if you look at her entire record, she's a hawk. There's no question about it. She believes that using the military and using American diplomacy and intelligence services in a forcible way is an appropriate response to crises around the world. Now, one would think that given the past 13 years and all the things that have gone wrong, that this kind of philosophy would be discredited. So I greatly fear a Hillary Clinton presidency. I think it would be as bad in many respects as Mitt Romney or John McCain.
I happen to agree with you there as well. There's been a lot of talk about Elizabeth Warren, who has been a major critic of the U.S. Of the Congress's economic policies and giving Wall Street another break, another out, the banks another out. But again, Elizabeth Warren knows where the third rail is, and she has also pronounced herself as a supporter of Israeli policy, as has Bernie Sanders. This is obviously a requirement to serve in the U.S. Congress.
Yeah, I think it has become that. I know certainly I was watching some of the local elections here in Virginia, and AIPAC was going around and vetting the candidates months before the voting actually took place. It's the way they operate. I mean, you've got to be right on Israel or you're going to be destroyed by the media or people are going to get the word out that you're not electable and therefore you won't get donations to support your campaign. There are a lot of things they can do. And it's unfortunate that that's true. And Elizabeth Warren is unfortunately a decent progressive on many, many issues that a lot of us would support. But when it comes to foreign policy, she, again, she knows where the third rail is.
I'd like to get back and to look into what the prospects are for the new year in various areas of the world, given the change of scene of congressional committees and running both houses of Congress, at least the Senate. What is your take on the prospects of U.S.-Cuban relations? Obama seems to have done made a major break with the U.S. foreign policy, and this has been greeted with approval by business community, which wants to do business with Cuba. Some former Cuban Americans who own property in Cuba think they might get it back. Is this a change, do you think, in policy or tactics?
Well, I think it's a change in policy. I think that Obama kind of figured here this was an issue that he had really nothing to lose on, because even the Republican Party is as it, given its ties to business, the business community is kind of split on this. And the ones that are the hardliners are themselves Cuban Americans. And again, this immediately raises the specter of, well, why don't they leave their quarrels back at home when they leave a country and come here? And so I think they have very little credibility on this issue, and I think that Obama made a good move and a decent move, because the sanctions basically against Cuba have not helped anyone, any Cuban, have not helped stability or security in the Western Hemisphere, and basically have done nothing but damage. So I am enthusiastically behind this, and I think everybody I know, you know, former intelligence officers, former State Department officers, are also very, very pleased with it.
Well, that's, as I said earlier in my program, that's the one positive thing to report on in looking to the future. How much can the Republicans do to who oppose that to block it?
Well, they have some well-placed people. Obviously, Rubio is going to be active against it. Ileana Ross-Lehtinen, who heads the House Foreign Affairs Committee, is a Cuban-American, is going to be working against it. But I think at the same time, they're going to find that the support for a hardline policy within the Republican Party itself is pretty meager. I think they're not going to see any groundswell of support for it. I mean, there'll be some posturing and there'll be some, oppose communism and that sort of thing, that kind of rhetoric. But I think that rhetoric is kind of dead now. It's kind of old fashioned.
Well, let's move across the ocean. The U.S. has escalated its economic war on Russia, and some people have predicted that it could end up in being a shooting and even possible nuclear war between the United States and Russia, which seems far-fetched, but one never knows. In these situations, there's been a major push for more and more sanctions. The collapse of the price of oil, which in one sense is going to make fracking more expensive and make boom towns in North Dakota dry up, perhaps. But perhaps you could talk about what the prospects are, what you think are the prospects for situation in Ukraine, and tie it in with the falling oil prices.
Yeah, I did an article on this, I think, about a month ago. I think it was for the American Conservative. And I basically said that you don't want to take an enemy like, or, let's not call Russia an enemy, because prior to all this, they weren't. They were a competitor, just like China is a competitor with the United States. But they weren't actually an enemy. And when all this stuff started on Ukraine, which essentially began with the United States initiating a coup in the Ukraine to expel a democratically elected government, this situation has been going from bad to worse. It's obviously being driven by a lot of neoconservatives and their friends in various constituencies in our government. Obama has very, I think, foolishly played along with this, gone along with this, because the only compelling issue in relations with Russia is to try to maintain good relations, because Russia is the only country in the world that can destroy the United States. So anyway, this has all been forgotten. I think now what we're seeing is that Russia's economy, not just because of sanctions, but more so because of the fall of oil prices, is in trouble. And you don't take a country like that and back it into a corner where there's no way out. And that's just increasingly what we're doing when we're cranking up more sanctions. We're increasingly hostile to everything Moscow does. And essentially, it's a fool's game. It's a game that can only end badly. I hope that it's not the sort of thing that can end in a shooting war. But if Ukraine becomes part of NATO, which a lot of people are pushing for, that could very well happen.
I know already some of the former members of the Soviet Union, like Lithuania, are getting rapid response forces if they think the Soviet Russia is going to invade across the border, which seems to ignore the provocations that actually led to the annexation of Crimea and to the fighting that's going on in eastern Ukraine, and including the strange story, the accusations around the shooting down of the Malaysian airliner, which the separatists did allow. I watched it on television, RT, did allow inspectors from European countries to come in and look at the wreckage during the fighting. So the distortions in the U.S. media of that situation continue.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's been right from the beginning, the whole media coverage of what's been going on in Ukraine. And you know, you can even go earlier than that. Think of how the U.S. media covered the Sochi Olympics. It was totally negative coverage. And here Russia was making a supreme effort, holding out its hand and basically saying, come join with us. And we had leading U.S. politicians and European politicians boycotting the games. And this was before Ukraine. I mean, this is basically, something is in the DNA out there that is forcing some of the neoconservatives and some of these people who are anti-Russian for all kinds of different reasons to come out of the woodwork. But it's dangerous. It's a dangerous game.
Well, let's move from there to Iran. We have an extension of the negotiations. It's obvious, or appears obvious, that the Obama administration would like to get a deal with Iran, to put as part of his legacy as the recognition or reopening relations with Cuba. There is tremendous pressure by the Israel lobby to destroy those negotiations. And I believe, and I said on my program when she did it, and Dianne Feinstein's speech a year ago September, in which she went on the Senate floor and said a vote for further sanctions or implementing further sanctions would be an act of war, seemed to stop the rush of Democrats to sign on to a bill that another Cuban-American, maybe the most dangerous one, Roberto Menendez, the senator of New Jersey, had initiated with Senator Mark Kirk. What do you think the prospects are for, as far as you can tell, for some kind of a deal, or at least maintaining the status quo with Iran in the coming year?
Well, I'm somewhat pessimistic about that. I think that come next month, we're going to have, obviously, the new Congress in place. I think one of the first things they're going to do is tighten up sanctions or increase sanctions against Iran. Now, the danger of that is that Iran has its own internal problem, which is that essentially there are hardliners who don't want to deal with the West. And Rouhani is basically working against them, and I think working very successfully. And he recognized the fact that that it is in Iran's interest to have some kind of agreement, just as it is in the United States' interest. So you're going to have the two kind of dissident forces maybe joining hands on this, and that will make it very difficult for Rouhani to come to some kind of agreement. President Obama can ignore a lot of this as long as there is still some dialogue going on. I hope he'll have the courage to do that. But he's kind of demonstrated in the past when he runs into really a serious obstacle, he'll back down. And, you know, we've seen that recently with the torture report and other things where he should be taking a more ethical line, a line that is more sensible in terms of actual interest, but he's always reluctant to do that.
Well, speaking of the torture report, he has criticized the activities and actions of the torture. He did that when he first came to office, but he took his position despite being elected as an anti-war president, in which he was supported by the Democratic Party leadership, not to prosecute or investigate potential war crimes or why the United States, how it got into war in the first place. Perhaps he knew where that path would lead, to the Office of Special Plans run by the neocons in the Pentagon. Yeah. But again, he has his director, John Brennan, who was involved at the time, I believe, in the CIA, has called the Senate report over the top. And here is a situation in which the world sees this report come out, and at the same time, which is a positive, and kudos to Senator Feinstein again for pushing this. But again, they see nothing is being done. And on the very same day that they announce that nothing will be done, the Obama administration announces that, they mention that there are going to be sanctions against certain officials in Venezuela that are, they're going to hold responsible for the deaths of certain protesters and anti-government protesters. So it's like crimes committed by Americans are going to be waived, and the United States seems to go around the world looking for countries to sanction.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I read that report of the sanctions on Venezuela, and I said, oh, my God. And it's as far as I'm concerned, you know, if the president believes himself to be at the head of a country that is ruled by laws rather than men, well, then he has no choice, but he should be taking steps to identify and prosecute everyone involved in torture. But he won't do that, and because he's making a political calculation that we won't be more trouble than it's worth. It might not even be doable. And okay, I get that to a certain extent, but why not have some candor here? Why doesn't he go on television or on his Saturday radio broadcast and say, look, this is the reality of politics in America? I think a lot of people would appreciate hearing something like that. But yeah, we look like hypocrites everywhere. We are basically a nation that's regarded by most of the world as in negative terms. And I travel a lot, and I hear this all the time. And I go to countries where there was a lot of pro-American sentiment prior to the last 10 years. And all of these countries now have a very jaundiced view of the United States. And you know, this is basically a result of the fact that we're hypocrites.
My guest is Phil Giraldi. We're talking about U.S. foreign policy in the new year and currently. It's interesting. There's been very little publicity that I've seen of a meeting that took place, a trip of Vladimir Putin took to India with the new prime minister of Crimea, in which the new head of prime minister of India, who is considered to be pro-West, hailed Russia as our historically greatest ally, and they signed a deal with the Russians for the Russians to build 22 new nuclear reactors, and that Russia would continue to be the leading provider of India's weapon systems. And atop that, there is evidently a business community in India which allies itself with the Ukraine and are going to do business with the Ukraine, which is being boycotted by European, with European sanctions. And that does not seem to get much recognition, but I think that much of the world sees the United States as somewhat of a paper tiger, and that the respect or fear or whatever what the United States can do is not seen as being unlimited.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment, and I did follow that trip to India as you did, and drew the same conclusion. And also another thing to mention is, if one accepts that Russia and China are competitors with the United States, there's nothing the United States could do better than the current foreign policy than to push those two competitors together. The Russians and Chinese have also been cutting a lot of deals. And the United States' response to all of this basically has been a military pivot to Asia, which admittedly is a little bit hard to understand why that's taking place, and the pressure that we're putting on Ukraine and we're putting on Russia. This is an insane policy. It's a policy designed to make enemies where you didn't have any, and to make people who are competitors but basically friendly turn them into enemies. I mean, this is just amazing.
Well, even in the sanctions against Russia, those have been opposed by many business elements in Europe and in Britain. And even the New York Times reported that the Obama administration didn't want to get too far ahead of Europe on these sanctions, because the sanctions actually have negatively affected the European economy, which purchased fuel from Russia. But also, Russia has been a major market for European goods, and the Russians turned around, Putin turned around, and then sanctioned Europe. So. European goods, and so the European manufacturers had to find other markets for their goods. The United States doesn't have this problem, so obviously, quite on an economic level, this would build resentments against the United States that Americans are totally unaware of.
Yeah, I must admit, I follow the European media a lot, and I don't see a whole lot of support for going after Russia. I think the only European leader who's kind of verbal on the issue has been Angela Merkel of Germany. Cameron, of course, in Britain is always the lapdog, but the rest of the European countries see that there is an upside and a downside to a lot of this stuff, as you point out. And there's not a lot of enthusiasm for these policies. These policies, first of all, are not going to make Russia change what it's doing, because for them, Crimea and national security issues are more important than any of the peripheral issues are to the Europeans or the Americans. So they're not going to change their policies, and it's essentially just a lot of smoke and everything about issues that that really we shouldn't be touching. We should just leave alone. And but they're dangerous, because these small issues can come together to create a big issue, and then we have a big issue, which potentially could even lead to war.
And speaking of leading to war. We have on the crisis, of course, with the Islamic State or Daesh in the Middle East, which our Secretary of State tells us will go on for years, and has just passed $1 billion in expenditures. But I wanted to shift to the Israel-Palestine conflict, which seems to just be running on a treadmill with the same warnings of dire consequences. But it seems that Israel has a government that more likely resembles the Tea Party than anything else, and has made moves so far to the right that Netanyahu could be seen as some of a centrist. And he's called for new national elections as his poll numbers had dropped. Meanwhile, the Palestine Authority, which collaborates with Israel, has threatened to break off ties with Israel if the UN Security Council doesn't pass a resolution calling for Israel to withdraw from the occupied territories in 2 years. It just seems, however, like a charade that keeps going on and on without any fundamental changes. What do you see happening in that conflict over the next year?
Well, I, in fact, do see some incremental changes that are taking place. I think over the past year, certainly, Israel has been less and less defensible, even by people who are strongly partisan regarding it. You've seen a number of books coming out from Jewish American journalists who have slammed Israel, have slammed the kind of fascistic society that is developing there. This election is almost certainly going to move Israel even, as you know, even further to the right, to the real land of the crazies. We're talking about the possibilities that Avigdor Lieberman or Naftali Bennett could become conceivably even prime minister. This will be a major blow to any kind of argument that Israel is a normal place. So I see that moving in one direction. The Palestinians, I think their bid to go to the UN is long overdue. I think that, in fact, Abbas, having collaborated with the Israelis to the extent that he has been a result of American pressure. And I think that the Palestinians get absolutely nothing out of it. There has to be something that breaks the ice here, and an overwhelming vote in the United Nations, in which it would be really nice if the United States would abstain, would be that sort of thing. It would be a signal to Israel that, hey, you're just not on the same page as the rest of us anymore.
Well, it's interesting the number of European countries that have joined the many small countries in recognition of Palestine and really implying even more economic pressure, perhaps, on Israel if it does not do something to move in that direction. But on the ground, Israel has done just about everything it possibly can to foreclose the possibility of a remotely viable Palestinian state. But ironically, the most right wing of the Israelis, Avigdor Lieberman and Naftali Bennett, talk about a one state, but the one state would be a Palestinian minority that would be totally subject to the rule of the Israeli Jews, who, by the way, most people aren't aware of here, but they're not considered Israeli citizens. People in Israel are, their nationality is their ethnic group. And so there isn't such a thing as an Israeli, except in the media. There you're a Jew or Muslim or Druze or whatever. People are so unaware of what we call a country that was supposed to have shared values. But in the media here, we have not seen even one major columnist, maybe you have, I haven't, who criticizes Israel and takes a side of the Palestinians.
No, I don't think that would be too much to hope for. But as I say, there has been considerable commentary that is, while it's not favorable to Palestinians, is critical of Israel. And that's a change. And that's a welcome change. So I see that as a positive development. And as you note, of course, the fact that so many European countries have already gotten on board, their parliaments anyway, in terms of voting to recognize Palestine as an independent state, that's another good sign. Because when the politics start to shift, there will be other things that shift too. The Europeans as a bloc, I mean, the biggest market for Israeli goods and everything is Europe. And when the politics shift, then the economic shift too, and suddenly you're going to start having boycotts, more boycotts. You're going to have probably sanctions of some kind following on that. If Israel doesn't get the message that essentially the time has come for a Palestinian state, and you guys can work it out any way you want, but you've got to work it out.
Well, it certainly that will be a major topic when the Republicans take power, because they have made a very, it hasn't been reflected in the voting booths, but the Republicans, in terms of going after the money, have made a major effort to become more pro-Israel than the Democrats. And I expect you see that that will be reflected in the actions of the Senate committees and House committees that deal with Israel in the coming year.
Yeah, but my argument would be against that, that the United States is becoming increasingly irrelevant in the process. I think there's a whole lot of world out there that is now suddenly starting to wake up to the issue. Many of them were awake already. But now when the Europeans start to distance themselves from the pro-Israel U.S. policy, suddenly that changes the equation. I think that, the United States, for various reasons, is going to be in Israel's corner. It's going to be in Israel's corner forever, one fears. But the fact is that that ain't enough anymore. I think that Israel will be increasingly isolated, and it really just does not matter that the United States is backing it.
Well, on that positive note, Phil, I want to thank you so much for being back on us, with us on Takes on the World today. Best wishes for Christmas and a great new year. I look forward to seeing you again in the new year, and keep writing those columns in the UNS Review. Folks, every week Phil has another column there, and just the UNS, just do Phil Giraldi, UNS Review, UNZ Review, and you will get informed. So thanks again for being our guest, and again, best wishes. Take care.
Same to you, Jeff. Thanks very much.